Okay, everybody. So this week we're going to talk about how to set up an individual sponsored trip from scratch. So last week we talked about the different types of free travel for travel writers in terms of the difference between a fam trip or familiarization trip, a press trip, and the larger bucket of individual trips. So today I'm going to say sort of interchangeably individual trip or individual fam. So today we're going to talk about a couple different things, because when it comes to setting up a sponsored trip, there's sort of a season, a time and a place for doing individual trips, and we're going to look at why or when you shouldn't try to set one up. But first we're going to look at why people would even let you do these things in the first place. As in, given the world today in terms of shrinking magazine budgets, in terms of everybody, you know, being focused on their Google ad spend, their videos, why are they spending money to send one journalist or blogger anywhere? And then we're going to look at a pretty crazy road trip that I took, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago now, that is a good case study for setting up lots of different types of individual things, because there's a lot of destinations, some that are different sizes, so it'll let you see the answers to a lot of different questions that I've seen people have in advance of this call about how to set up certain things. So I've been on both sides of the desk about the magazine side of things, but as a travel writer, I was thinking about this when we were setting up the call. I don't do a lot of funded travel, I feel like, but I guess just because I've been doing this for so long, I have taken quite a few individual press trips and some group press trips over the years, but I don't think I've ever had a single press trip request be completely turned down. And I know some of the folks that had sent me some things in advance of the call were having trouble getting various things done, and I think it's going to come down to a lot about who you ask. And so we'll look into that in a second. So before we get into the process of setting things up, it's really important to remember why these people are giving you these opportunities in the first place. And the thing is that the reasons have really changed, and we talked last week about this thing called the column inch formula. If any of you guys were with us there, you might remember, but I'll just recap for the folks who weren't. So the column inch calculation is an antiquated way that people from tourism boards and PR firms used to decide how much money to invest in a writer who was coming for a trip. So what it meant was that they would look at the physical space in a newspaper in terms of inches that an article that this person was going to write would take up, and compare the space of that article as an editorial feature to the price of an ad that was the same size as that article. And they'd say, okay, if this ad costs $17,000, then we can spend up to $17,000 on this person's trip. Or if what they're asking for costs less than $17,000, then we should say yes. So because there's so many different ways to advertise now, this has totally gone out the window. And I often see people saying, well, I also have a blog and I'm also an influencer, and you know, I can offer them this, that, and the other thing. But the thing is that sometimes that doesn't matter. And so it's kind of a weird situation now, because even if you have a huge influence, even if you are writing for a very major outlet, it doesn't always make a difference to them if it doesn't line up with their goals. So what this means is that if you are pitching a CVB, a tourism board, a DMO, somebody high level that's in charge of one whole destination, whether it's large or small, or statewide or countrywide, and what you pitch them might sound fantastic and it would be really great coverage and it would be interesting stories, but they, in their meetings with their bosses and their bosses' bosses, and eventually the director of tourism for the whole region, have other goals in terms of what coverage they are able to fund at that moment, it doesn't matter how cool your thing is or how great your coverage is. They're going to say, great, go ahead, do that coverage, but we can't help you with it. So as we are thinking about how to send emails to these people, specifically who to target and what information we can use to hook them and make them interested in helping us, it's really important that we always, 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 always ground it with a very central and primary look at what is in it for the specific person that you are asking. So what that means is if you're asking the PR firm, that represents a destination, you have to remember, you're not just asking the destination, you're asking the PR person who has a job which is specifically to get coverage for this destination, perhaps a specific kind of coverage. So in that case, you might look at the sort of, you know, success stories that that PR firm has on its website in terms of the type of coverage that they've gotten for other places, and that would allow you to know that that's what they consider to be a win for their client, which is the destination. Likewise, you can go to a CVB and see what articles they've shared that journalists have written about them in the past, and you can see what's considered a win for them. So when we say what's in it for them, it's not necessarily what's in it for the it version of the destination, the gender-neutral nameless thing of the destination, but specifically for the individual that you are trying to get on your side with this pitch so that they help you take your trip for free. Okay? So coverage alone is not always enough these days. And so this goes back to what we were talking about influencers earlier. So in some cases, saying that you will not only be writing these print articles, but you will also be tweeting it and Instagramming it and everything live while you are there is very attractive. But the other things that can be attractive are giving a good breadth in terms of media in your coverage. So you can say that you're going to be doing, you know, some videos that will be shared here, here, and there. But the other thing that you can do, and we talked about this a little bit in some of our other webinars on travel content marketing, is that you can be pitching to go to these destinations as an individual sponsored trip without any editorial attachment at all. So you're not doing any stories, but you're just producing content through an individual sponsored trip for the destination, for a hotel company, for a tour company. So if you're more interested in getting on these trips and making cool trips and going to these places than specifically getting print bylines or online bylines out of these visits, this can be a really great way to do it, is to create a partnership with the tourism board, with a hotel company, with a tour company, to create a big batch of content for them around the destination through a trip that you go on. And I was just at TBEX in Jerusalem last week, and this guy did a talk that was ostensibly about how bloggers can work with brands, and ended up being a lot about SEO, which was interesting in its own right. But one of the very, very first things he said was that brands are not looking to pay for trips for bloggers to write on their own blogs. They're looking for people to write on the brand's blog, not the blogger's blog. So often when I have people come to me and say, oh, I'd like to go on such and such trip, and here's my pitch, I look at it and it's really all about their blog and them as an influencer. So it's failing the what's in it for me factor from the first point, because you're not spinning what you're going to do for that destination or that hotel through your background and through your experience. But also, it might not be important to them for you to come and tweet about it or do it, Instagram posts about it, because they might have much, much bigger influencers who are mommy bloggers or fashion bloggers or whatever, who they already have doing that. So you need to look at where you can align with what they are looking to spend money on, what they already have budget on. Because if they simply don't have budget for something, you're not going to get anywhere. So a couple don'ts, okay? So don't try to set up an individually sponsored trip when you are traveling in high season. This is a huge one, okay? Go ahead and drop in the chat box if you've ever tried to go like to Europe in the summer or something like that and just been completely shut out every time you tried to get, you know, as little as a tour set up or something like that. Because this is one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make, and it's newer, because I think before blogs became big, all the print journalists knew you don't travel in high season because their print deadlines forced them to write those stories earlier and take those trips earlier. So for instance, I have only recently started doing travel for research in the spring or the summer. I used to always be in Europe like in February or October or all these times when it was cold and kind of rainy and gray and basically kind of shitty, to be honest. And all these poor tourism people, like my tour guides and stuff like that, would be like, oh, I'm so sorry, you have to see it now. Oh, and I was like, but, you know, this is the only time to see it. Either this or I have to go an entire year in advance and then wait for my story to come out, which for me, from a financial point, just doesn't make sense. And I know a lot of you guys have voiced that concern as well about having a story assigned, but they don't want it for 2 years because they want you to travel in the summer because it's a summer story. So another thing, and this is one of these places where there's an exception to the rules for sure, but be very careful about looking to set up free trips and leading or including in your pitch that you're looking for travel for somebody besides yourself. So the main exception to this rule is if you are inherently like a family travel writer, then you should be experiencing it with your kids because you want to be writing about what their experience is like as well. But this kind of myth that you can take your spouse on all these great weekend trips because you're going on press trips and, you know, it's all paid has been perpetuated by some very specific people. And in fact, I was looking at an ebook on the topic of setting up free trips in preparation for this call that's written by somebody else. And he leads with talking about all these different lovely trips that he's been on or that other people he know has been on, and saying that he and his wife go here and had dinner here and a romantic weekend there. And the thing is, if you are writing specifically for the romantic travel market, then it's often a given that you'll be bringing your spouse. But it's not something that you should ever assume. And I typically let the tourism board take the lead in telling me if I should think about bringing somebody else. But the funny thing that happens is often the times that you would travel and potentially they would ask you to bring somebody else are midweek or sometime when it wouldn't really make sense for you to bring your significant other or family. But always let the tourism board take the lead on that. Never assume that you can bring your significant other, and never say that your friend or your significant other is your photographer unless they actually are. This is another thing that I see a lot of couples try to do, is say that one person is like the assistant or the photographer, but people can tell really fast if the other person has no idea how to research or do travel writing. Okay, so the other thing, and I mentioned this last week, but I'm just going to give a little background again, is that if you're trying to do just one story for a small outlet or an online outlet that's not, like, say, BBC Travel, that's probably like the only one that stands alone on its merits and is just online. If you're trying to do just one story for one outlet that is not Travel and Leisure with a first-tier city or even the second-tier city, so that means New York, San Francisco, Seattle, maybe even Cleveland, any of these cities that have a sports team, say, okay, if you're trying to go there and get sponsored travel for one story for a not household name outlet, they're going to offer you like something worth $20. So I say the Seattle situation because for last week's call, Maria had sent me something for us all to discuss together, which was that she had emailed and also filled out the form and sent a very nice cover letter, then checked all the boxes, done everything she was supposed to do to the Seattle Tourism Board to get something set up for a trip that she already had assigned. So she had the assignment, you know, she had all the ducks in the row. She was doing it for the essentially Associated Press of Finland. But what happened was that they pulled a column inch calculation on her. They said, can you tell us the readership and give us the ad rates, because they didn't know her outlet and they wanted to calculate to see what was the equivalent for them to spend to get an ad in that location. And they looked at it and they decided that the only thing that they would offer her is a sort of Visit Seattle pass, like those things that give you free public transit and entrance to museums and things like that. And the thing about those passes is that they're usually very easy to get. They're like the baseline. Like if you can prove you have a story and you're going to a large city, like they just hand them out like candy from their desks at the tourism board. So that's the kind of thing where you can take that one story that you have from one outlet that they might not know and add four others that also might be from outlets that they don't know. And then you're starting to put together a case. You're starting to put together a portfolio that shows that you actually do need media assistance, because for the large tourism boards, and it's different for the small ones, and we're going to talk about that when we go through the example, but for the large tourism boards, they call it media assistance for a reason, because it's really set up to be for media who have stories lined up who wouldn't be able to complete those stories without the help of the tourism board. So one of the really great things that I recommend, how many of you, by the way, I should have asked this earlier, how many of you drop in the chat box if you have been on a sponsored trip that was just you, okay, so not necessarily with a group like a press trip, but a sponsored trip that was just you, or that you have never been on a sponsored thing that was just you. So this can be a tour, it can be a meal, it can be a hotel staying, anything like that. So drop over here in the chat box just a yay or nay if you've been on an individual sponsored thing or not. Oh, Stacy, that's great. Which newspaper was it? Yeah, some people are saying that they've been on group ones only. Yep, hotel stays. Oh, great, the Tribune, great. So we've got a good mix. So I feel like one of the things that I'm noticing from a lot of people who are saying yes, they have, is that it's often been in connection with a story that was assigned. And this is the thing, if you are new to travel writing or new to sponsor trips, and you know, I've seen a couple people in here who say they've done it with their partner, and one, for instance, is somebody who I know writes about family travel. So like I said, that's definitely the exception to the rule about don't ask for things for more than just yourself. If you write about family travel, then that's a no-brainer that you should be asking to take your family as well. But if you are new either to free travel or travel writing, one of the best things you can do is to start doing day trips, so things near where you live or in your own city, if you do a big city, if you live in a big city, that are sort of little chunks of sponsored things. So you have a tour, or you have a tour and a meal and an overnight in a hotel or something like that. And then what you do is you take those examples. So you go on the things, you write your stories, and then you put together these little case studies. And I'm going to do a whole webinar all about case studies, specifically for content marketing and things like that, in a little while. But the way that you do these case studies for press trips is that if you have a blog, you might already be familiar with this because some people include it in their media kit, but you just create a little one-pager or a couple-page PDF, and you can do this in PowerPoint if you don't have any sort of layout software, because PowerPoint is a good way to hack making a nice-looking PDF. But you say where you went, what you were offered, what was free, and the stories that came out of it. And you know, if there were stories that went online, you can say how many social shares, or if you have access to the Google Analytics, you can say how many eyeballs they got, or something like that. But you can also just include the links and a nice little screenshot or scan of the article. And I'm not going to talk too much about how to set up your website to kind of impress people into giving you a free trip right now, because I don't think it's too important. I realized actually as I was preparing this call that I get invited on all sorts of stuff. Like I use the example a lot of this press trip that I didn't go on to Dubai. I get invited on stuff that has like nothing to do with what I do, that sounds really interesting and luxurious. And my website, like I don't even have most of my clips on there. I don't even think I have National Magazine clips on there. Like I have very little stuff up there. But one thing I do is I include the layouts of the article. So if it's a print article, I either get the digital version and I take a PDF just of the spread that has the article, or if it's something online, I take a screenshot, as long as it's a good-looking website. If it's not a good-looking website, don't worry about it. But I find that displaying that your articles appear somewhere nice, it has a nice presentation, and I've heard this from both editors and from tourism boards, that can go a long way with people. So when you're putting together this case study, you'll show, you know, who the tourism board was or who the tour company was or whatever, what you received from them, what the coverage was like, and it's just, that's all you really need to have, okay? And just having that one bit of professional collateral, so to say, can really go a long way with setting up these trips. And so when you are emailing people, and we're going to get to who to email in a minute, but when you're emailing people to set these things up, as you're listing, you know, I'm a full-time freelance travel writer, I've been writing for this many years, I write regularly for this and that publication, and I've put together some examples of trips that I've been on in the past and the coverage that those trips received. And then you just put like a Dropbox link or something to the document. That goes a long way because the people who work in these tourism boards and PR companies are used to these slide deck style things to look at, brochures and things like that. You know, it's like what they give you as a press person, they respond to that because that's what they're used to giving. So you put together your own sort of press pack to give back to them. Okay, so I didn't say this last week, so I want to make a small aside about when you should not travel for free in an editorial function. So go ahead and drop in the chat box if this is something you've been curious about. But because I live in New York, I always get asked about the New York Times. It's kind of like an inside joke with tourism people, I think, that the New York Times says it doesn't accept press trips, and everybody knows somebody from the New York Times that they've been on a press trip with. And my answer is always, I go on press trips, so I don't pitch the New York Times. But the vast, vast majority of publications really don't care if you've been on a press trip, to the point where they will often tell you explicitly, feel free to drop my name to set up a trip, or would you like me to connect you to the tourism board person to help set up your trip? So a lot of this has to do with shrinking travel budgets on the publication side. However, there are some sad holdouts, and I say sad for this reason, like the New York Times, that have very strict policies. So the New York Times, theoretically, I'm not sure how it works, but they do a background check on you. And if you have taken any free travel in the last 3 years or had a history of accepting free travel before that, then you can't write for them. And so people who I know who write for them are so fastidious that they will be at cocktail parties at conferences and like trying to make sure that people don't tweet their name in connection to the party being sponsored by somebody. So you have to be really, really careful with the Times. But the problem is that these outlets don't actually pay so much. So for instance, the Times is known that it won't pay your travel, but it won't let you accept any. So if you want to write about Kandahar for the New York Times, you have to already be there. So in some cases, and Joe just mentioned this in the chat box, there is a bit of a don't ask, don't tell policy. And so it's a little tricky because there are some publications that will get angry if it was a sponsored thing and you didn't tell them. But by and large, I've seen that the ones that are in that position will ask you right away. So if you pitch them and they like the article and they care, so they, it's not that they totally don't care and support free trips, and it's not that they don't have a don't ask, don't tell policy, but they would get angry if you had taken a free trip. They will typically tell you when they are interested in your article, like, this looks good, let's talk about it a little bit. Was this a sponsored trip? And if it was, then they'll say, sorry, we can't accept this story. So don't worry too much about saying up front that it was a sponsored trip. I know a lot of people come to me and say when they're pitching a story that they, or that they want to go on a press trip, they want to lead their pitch by saying, I've been invited on this trip, blah, blah, blah. Don't do that. Okay, so we're talking about sponsored trips that are individual today, so this isn't so much the case, but don't put in a pitch, and especially don't lead your pitch by telling the editor that you were pitching them a story because it was a free trip, because editors don't like that. So, yeah. So, Lenora had mentioned that some people talk about being a lifetime ban at the New York Times, and this is something I haven't personally tested, but in theory, if you've gone on, you know, more than a handful of press trips or had free lunches or whatever, then you might have a lifetime ban from the New York Times. But I hope that one day that will open up, because actually Condé Nast Traveler used to have a policy that was very similar, not about the ban, but about no free travel. And they polled their readers, and I actually sat in on one of these reader sort of survey sessions, and their readers didn't care. They didn't really care if the travel was free or if Condé Nast had paid for it themselves. And so they've now loosened their policy. Okay, so let's get into how exactly we go about planning these things. So again, if you have a trip that you have coming up that you want us to sort of tie into this section of the call, please feel free to drop it in the chat box. This is a good time to do that. And there's a couple that I had seen come in, and so I'm just gonna see if some of those people are on the call, because otherwise I can email them back later. Okay, great, so Lena's here. Nobody. Okay, guys, I can workshop your stuff if you want, but feel free to just drop it in later on if you think about it. Okay, so one thing that I had noticed with both the one that Lena had sent and also in somebody, one that I had talked to somebody about who isn't on the call but is probably going to listen to the recap, is setting up your own accommodation and your own travel and then doing the rest, so doing the activities and things like that through the local tourism office. And I'm going to talk about that in the context of the attack order right now. So this is essentially also what I use when I'm doing trips that are not sponsored, but it's particularly important to go in this order when you're doing sponsored trips, okay? Because like I said before, like the number one cardinal rule of don't pitch a press trip when is if you're trying to go on high season, okay? So if it's really important to you to get the trip set up for free, either because like Jill mentioned, she wants to go on a cruise to Antarctica, okay? So if that's something that is not in your bandwidth to be paying for completely out of pocket and you want to do a media rate or you want to get it sponsored, you need to think really hard about this point here, okay? Because if you can be more flexible about your dates, you can often get a much better setup. And I've been in situations where I needed to go somewhere and I was even going there last minute and they had like their biggest tourism thing of the year set up. And they were able to accommodate me, but only because I both had an assignment and I wrote about that destination like once every 3 or 4 months. So there are some exceptions to that high season rule. Like I said, there's some exceptions to all those rules, but they tend to be built a lot about relationships, okay? So start your trip planning if you need the first two things, which are transit and lodging, both early and by looking at the destination's high season. Particularly the destination's high season. So not the region's high season, but the destination. Because it might be that you're going somewhere very, very cold in January when you would think it's not their big time of year, but they have their Winterfest in January when they build, you know, a whole village out of ice and people come from all around. And you might have already known about that and want to base your story about it, or maybe you don't. But this can be a way to find out either if there's good story angles that you don't know about but that might preclude you from getting a free trip, or if there's good story angles that you could potentially research another time. So I talked about this a bit last week, but the thing about a festival, and I don't think Kristen is here, but Kristen had asked last time about this festival in India that happens every October. If you want to cover a festival, this is really difficult for tourism boards because it's when their hotels are the most expensive, but you as the writer can't go any other time to get that. So anytime you're trying to cover something that really is like the highest season and a very, very busy time, that's when you want to be planning very far in advance. And so when you look at when to go, that's also combined with when to get in touch. So I always think that you should draft off of press trips to get a sense of when to get in touch. So what that means is that a lot of press trip invites kind of confound me, but they come out like 6 to 8 weeks before the trip would go out, or maybe like maximum 12 weeks, really, really maximum. And so that's kind of the time frame that people are looking at to fill these spots. But then you have to backtrack, right? Because before the press person put that trip together, put together the list of people to invite and started invited writers, then they've been organizing that internally, okay? So maybe 3 or 4 months, I would say, is the really common window of when people would be organizing these things. So generally, 3 to 4 months off of when you would want to go is when you should start to get in touch, because that also gives you leeway that if the specific week you're looking at has, you know, the International Association of Swine Doctors, I don't know, in town that week, which is not something that you would have ever found out about on your own, they can tell you and say, look, we have a big convention, but I could accommodate you the week after, okay? And if you're looking at doing something that's really like a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-year something, start looking at least 1 year in advance. So as soon as that festival finishes for the year this year, get in touch with them about how you can make it work to attend it the next year, okay? And we're going to talk about a little interesting hack that you can use to get invited places. It's really good for these festivals in a little bit, but I'll just give you a little tease here. So when you write a roundup about something, and a roundup is when you have, we also call it a basket of kittens a lot here, but a roundup is when you have several different things around a theme together in one call or in one article. And so that's a little bit different than a listicle, because they tend to be more tightly focused around one theme, but very diverse geographically. So what you can often do is you can write a roundup about something and do interviews by phone to get some information on that roundup. And in doing so, build a positive relationship with that tourism board, that destination, that tour company, whatever, and have them say at the end, oh, we'd love to show you around sometime. Let us know when you can come. And that's actually one of the best ways to get invites for individual press trips, is actually through doing an interview about the place for a different article by phone that you can then leverage into more articles. And that's also really helpful in terms of pitching because you've already gotten some background on the destination. I've got a couple questions over here I just want to look at quickly. Okay, so Joe had a question that goes right into my next point. So how to get there? This is like the elephant in the room when people talk about free trips because it's such a pain in the butt. So in fact, I was in a Facebook group that I'm in. I think it's the Travel Plus Social Good Media Group. Somebody was posting that she's setting up something with an airline for the first time. And I honestly just don't even approach airlines. I had in the past, and they're just such a pain in the butt to work with that I have always found it's easier for me to just get to accrue points and miles through credit cards and pay for my flights, whether I need business class flights or crazy flights or one-way flights between Japan and Reykjavik, Iceland, which is seriously an itinerary that I just booked the other day, that it is so much easier for me to do those on my own by using points. And so I'm still not paying for them, but I get the actual flights I want, and I don't have to spend weeks courting, you know, some variety of airline officials. But I do have friends that get a lot of airline things set up. But the thing is, it's because they read about the airline industry. So people who get airline trips set up that don't read about the airline industry tend to be looking for regional flights. It can be really hard to get international flights from the airlines directly set up for a big long-haul flight. So another interesting hack, which is not completely relevant to what we're talking about today, but if you have any friends who work for airlines, they have a certain number of friends and family passes that you can usually buy off them for like some negligible amount of money, and then you just have to pay the taxes and fees on your flight, and then they can book you a basically like free flight to South Africa or whatever. But if you want to get your flight sponsored, the best way to do that is actually to go to a third party. So that third party is either the tourism board, which is what Joe mentioned here, or a hotel. And this is a really weird way of looking at it, but I'm going to talk more about this in a minute, but hotels are really where the money for sponsored trips is these days. They're the ones that are putting together these really splashy itineraries where they're flying people across the world. I had somebody in the Philippines for an Eco Lodge say that they wanted to bring me the other day. And the thing about these trips is they're really nice if you have a lot of time. So hotel trips are great for writers who are doing travel writing part-time, you know, capacity, like they like a good way to pay for their vacations or to take their family interesting places, or for people who are doing travel writing as like a second, third, fourth career, and it's kind of an interesting retirement and you don't care so much about the income. Because, for instance, I could never go to a hotel for 5 or 6 days to basically just be at the hotel and do the amenities nearby. I just don't have the time. I have too much work. And that's been the case for pretty much the whole time that I've been a travel writer. And this gets back into deciding, you know, how much of your travel writing you want to be doing to earn a good amount of money versus that you just want to be traveling. And so I find that hotel trips can be not just the most luxurious because of the hotel, but because they have the budget. They're setting up crazy meals for you at their property and otherwise. They're setting up tours for you. They're doing the flights. They're doing all sorts of stuff. So when Maria, in the Seattle case that I had mentioned earlier, that she got sort of turned away by the tourism board because they didn't know what the Finnish media were, in that case, I said, go to the hotels. And there's a couple different ways to go to hotels, but just getting the name of the local PR person, which you can do online for any of the big chains, is not very hard. However, the thing about big chains, just like big tourism boards, is that they have their quotas, they have their priorities, and it can take a lot of, you know, journalist bling, so to say, to impress them. However, boutique hotels, especially new boutique hotels, and especially boutique hotels that come from a backer, which is pretty common. So in Italy, for instance, where I used to do a lot of work, these are often formerly noble families who have turned their family estate or their family villa or something into some sort of tourism, either like it's like a little mini village where everyone has their own house, or it's a hotel or something like that. These are the people we're putting on the cool trips, because to them, it's part of the brand. The whole experience is part of the brand, just like this Dubai press trip that I mention pretty often. So the reason we go in this order, when to go, how to get there, whatever, is that we're starting typically with the tourism board, with when to go, okay? We're letting them know that we're looking at coming, but they're not necessarily the one that we're looking at getting to pay for the rest of this or to put it together. We're often using them to see what we can get, but also to get more information about who is better able to support our trip, because they've got a lot of people coming to them. So in the case of Maria's Seattle trip, she was actually referred to a set of hotels that do have media rates or that do comp stays in conjunction with the tourism board to get in touch with, or the tourism board said that they would get in touch with them for her. So in terms of how to get there, like Joe mentioned, you can often get some more leverage with the airline by going to the tourism board, but if you're traveling regionally, I find that going to the train company or the person that does train passes, like Eurail is really great in Europe about working with journalists and bloggers. Amtrak also has a new program. Bus companies can be good for this. Bicycle companies can be good for this. Can give you more options and also more interesting stories than just having the tourism board try to set it up for you. Where to sleep is an interesting thing, because a lot of people these days, I've noticed, and in fact, Lena even mentioned in her email about the trip that she had a question about, oops, that she had already set up her hotel. But a lot of folks, myself included, just go right ahead and set up an Airbnb without even reaching out to hotels. But what can actually be interesting, if you have the tolerance for it, is to sleep in a different hotel every night. And that can be much easier to set up than asking a single hotel to give you 5 nights, 3 nights, whatever, because then each property doesn't have to pony up so much. They don't have to make a case to their boss about why you need to be there for so many nights. You don't need to come up with so many stories to explain why you're going to be there so many nights. And when you're writing a story about a place, you're often going to end up giving multiple lodging options anyway. So you would say, you know, for a luxury option, this hotel has recently opened, you know, started by a couple that's an interior designer and, you know, a craft brewer from Brooklyn, blah, blah, blah. For a budget option, da, da, da. For families, da, da, da. So staying in a different place every night, if you can stomach it personally, can be easier to set up and also better for your stories. Now, what to do? So now these bottom parts of what to do and where to eat, we're going through on timeline here, right? So this is 3 to 4 months, unless you want to go somewhere crazy, and then we're looking at 1 year out. Okay, how to get there? This is also going to be 3 or 4 months. Where to stay? This can be 2 to 3 months. You can even do it 1 month out. What to do? This is stuff you can be doing 1 month out or even 2 weeks out, because when you're looking at getting into attractions, it's typically just a matter of letting them know you're coming. So the one thing I have on another slide, but I just want to mention, is that this is a bit different in the U.S. versus other countries. But in the U.S., if you're media and you want to come and you want to come for free, you typically just need to be contacting them in advance, and then they put your name on a list at the door, and then you have a kit waiting for you when you come, and typically somebody also to guide you around. But what I really recommend, because one of the big differences between a group tour and an individual tour is the tour guidedness of it. So when you're on a group tour, a good group tour, you should have individual tour guides in all the places that you go to that are able to unpack the hidden stories, the anecdotes, the background, and give color and depth to the destination for you. And that's something that I think a lot of us, myself included, skip out on when we travel on our own. We think, oh, you know, I just need to get the hotel sponsored, and then I know I want to go to this, this, and this, and I want to profile this business, and I want to eat at this place. But you would be astonished. I'm sure most of you, and you know, drop over here in the chat box if you haven't had this experience, but most of you have probably at some point in your various travel writing journeys gone on a trip and experienced how even a place that you think you know, you can learn so many things from a tour guide. You know, I've taken a couple tours here in New York, and New York is a place that I've only lived for the last 7 or 8 years, but they're always fascinating. You know, that in a city like this, somebody can give you a tour of 2 blocks and just come up with so, so many stories. And my favorite sort of anecdote about the power of going on a tour is that I used to ghostwrite for an Italian concierge tour planning company. And so their job was to put together tours and itineraries for people around Italy. So they had to know things. They had to know the area. They had to know what was good. They had to know what would be a match for their clients. And they somehow had done this for several years without going on a tour, even though they were putting their clients on tours with tour guides. And then one day they went on a tour of the city where they actually owned their home in Italy, and they were just blown away. So if you have not been on a tour like that, I will tell you that doing that tour one-on-one versus doing that tour in a group is a such better experience. Because what happens is tour guides always tailor the tour to their audience. And so if it's just you, you get to really dig into what you want to know about the destination. And they go through their catalog of stories and their catalog of anecdotes, and they highlight ones for you that they usually don't do on their group tours, on their public tours. And you can ask them even deeper questions, and they're able to answer you because they're not neglecting other people on their trip. So in terms of the what to do category here, I really, really recommend when you're setting up sponsored trips on an individual basis that you also make sure to include some tours. And you can do them differently. Like you can do some, you know, food tours, of course. You can do some historic tours in the National Park Service, which I've actually worked with a lot. It seems like it would be hard to do press stuff with the National Park Service, but they're actually quite organized about it. They have some really, really great tours. Joe's got a point over here. It's even more interesting when you visit a destination with non-national tour guides based there, i.e. in the UAE, there are very few Emirati tour guides. You learn so much from these people because they're also discovering the place themselves. And what I really love about Joe's point is that those people, especially if they're from the country you're from, or even if they're not, know what is interesting to visitors about that destination. I find often locals, you know, they know some interesting stories, but they don't know what is new to you, and they don't highlight those facts. So tours can be very, very easy to set up, either by going through the CVB or by going directly to the tour company. Setting up tours, like most tour company owners, are just happy to set them up for you. I've never had any problem doing that, whether it's an individual tour or not. But the next thing that is harder is where to eat, okay? So obviously, I imagine most of us, because, you know, it's something we spend a lot of our hours, waking hours doing, and also probably writing about, care about where we eat on our trips, and it might be even the reason that we travel. But this can be one of the more difficult things to get sponsored, actually. And so even if you do get it sponsored, you get into this weird situation where you might be eating places that the tourism board has sent you to that are not actually the most interesting places because they're trying to guess what you would want to cover. So, well, you can certainly get your meals sponsored. And to do that, I recommend going through the tourism board and not directly to the restaurant, unless it is a restaurant group. If it's a restaurant group, then you go to the PR firm that represents the restaurant group, and then they will take care of it for you. But if you want to get your meals sponsored, just be very, very careful that you don't just give the tourism board carte blanche to set them up for you if you have specific places that you want to eat. Okay, so we've covered a couple of these points already, but we went through the attack order. Now, the specific setup process, like I said, is that we want to start with the CVB. We're starting with them to see what we can get, but also what we can get sponsored, but also to see what other information we can get from them. And I was going to flip over to my web browser to show you a couple things, but I won't do that now because we're getting short on time. But pretty much every CVB, especially the large cities, has like a, they call it like a what's hot list. And this is where they mention new places that are opening, renovations that are happening, all sorts of people who want coverage. So what's really, really brilliant about these lists is that they are tailor-made lists of who you can contact to set you up with free stuff. Because these people currently have a marketing budget, and they are looking to get more coverage for whatever their new thing is. So whether that's a hotel that's about to open, a restaurant that's just opened, you know, a new tour offered from an existing tour company, something like that, these things are in the market for coverage. So they are like a ready-made sponsored thing, and I highly recommend starting with those. The caveat is they tend to have very updated what's new lists from large cities where, like I said, it can be a little difficult to get things done. So when you see the what's new list, you could ask the CVB if they'll connect you, but you might be better off just finding the information of that particular hotel, restaurant, or company, whatever, and reaching out to them yourself. So you can also go for press releases that are not so specifically curated by the tourism board to a variety of wire services. And I'm not going to list them all because there's really a lot. But PR Newswire is pretty good for travel. And also Media Kitty, which has listings of press trips that are open and things like that, are a couple travel-specific places to think about. And if any of you guys have some that you like to use, that as a journalist you've used successfully in the past to find good press releases, drop them in the side and I'll mention them to the group. Somebody had a quick question, what does CVB stand for? So CVB is the industry word for Tourism Board. It means Convention and Visitors Bureau. And DMO, which is another abbreviation, oh thank you, Trav Media, I forgot Trav Media, that's another really good press release service for travel stuff. So DMO is similar to Tourism Board, except that it tends to be a private entity. It's called the Destination Management Organization, but they all accomplish the same purposes of the functionality of the Tourism Board in various cities. So sometimes when you're Googling who to contact, you might need to try, you know, the name. I always start with CVB for Google because that's usually how they're listed. I Google the name of the destination and CVB. These days, almost everybody's changed their website and sometimes even the name of their nonprofit or the company to be Visit whatever. So Visit, you know, Visit California, Visit Indy, Visit whatever. So that also works if the CVB query doesn't come up. And then you can also search for the name of the location and DMO. So I mentioned briefly Media Kitty. So there's a couple sites that aren't going to be necessarily useful for press releases of who you can reach out to cold, but you can just put up a thing that says, I'm coming to blah, blah, blah. If you have a new tour, a new restaurant, a hotel, whatever, this is the kind of stuff I'm looking to cover. Get in touch with me. So the two main places to do that are Media Kitty, which is more travel specific, and HARO, which stands for Help a Reporter Out. And I believe with Help a Reporter Out, you used to have to tag it to a specific destination, but that might not be true anymore. And if anybody has some updated information on that, I haven't used it in a couple years myself. Lena's asking, is there a good site that publishes press releases when major airlines launch flights to new destinations? Those will definitely be on both Trav Media and PR Newswire for sure, because I always see the airline ones. Those are just up all the time. But you can also set a Google alert for those as well. So if there's something like an airline that you want to know about, you can set Google alerts for those so that you don't need to be pawing through the sites every day. But also on PR Newswire and Trav Media, you can set something that you so that you get all of the travel press releases in just link title form in your email every day. So we talked about how tours are the easy part and flights and meals are not. But I want to touch on how free attractions work very differently in the U.S. and abroad. I've had some really hilarious instances, I think in part because I have a press pass and in part because I speak so many languages, with rants from museum officials in different countries about these Americans who come in and think that they can just walk in by showing a business card, and they're like, anybody can print a business card. And I'm like, well, anybody can print this press pass. Actually, the newspaper offices just print them themselves. But here's the thing. In the U.S., you cannot go up to a museum and just show them your press pass and get in. But that's how it works in Europe. So if you are primarily writing about the US, then it's really easy. You just write to the PR or marketing person in advance. However, if you're looking at writing a lot about Europe, and I don't have as much experience with this in Asia because I don't usually try to get free things when I'm there because I'm with my family. But if you are trying to go places in Europe, they will usually say very plainly on the entrance to the museum, you know, EU citizens price this, seniors price this, and I mean media is free, but with valid media card. So how do you get a press card? Okay, if you write regularly for a publication that is a newspaper, you can often get them to make one for you. I've seen some websites that do them also, but the primary way is to be in an association. So there's a few, and if you're new to travel writing, you do need to have a certain number of clips usually to get into them. But there's a couple that are a little easier. And so I'm going to send out an email when the reminders go out after the webinar. I'm going to drop those names in there so that you can see them. But the one caveat I will tell you is there's one that's run by another company that sells travel writing courses, which is not actually a travel writing association, but they do make press cards. And they essentially say, like, oh, pay us, you know, $200, and you get this press card. And I've seen that one get denied some places. So I will say, if you're trying to get a press card specifically to get in to museums and things like that in Europe or other places that are a bit more stringent, Lena had mentioned NATJA, and actually, oh, I think I can just chat this out to everybody. So NATJA is a pretty easy one, and this is the National North American Travel Journalists Association. SATW is the Society of American Travel Writers. That one's a bit harder. There's another one that I'm probably going to botch, but it's International Food, Wine, and Travel Writers Association. This one, like NATJA, is also a little bit easier. So if you have some background and you've written online, you can probably get into IFWTA and maybe also to NATCHA. NATCHA, I will say, is privately owned and run, so it's a for-profit company. So while that totally works as a press card and it is a legitimate travel writing association, it's not kind of as well editorially regarded as SATW. I'm not really sure the standing of the International Food, Wine, and Travel Writers Association in the battle between NATJA and SATW. Okay, so I've titled this slide "Blah Blah Networking Blah Blah" because how many times have people told you, "Oh, if you want this, you should go network. You should go to events. You should meet people. It's so easy to get gigs, to get free travel, if you just do that." But the thing is, like, yeah, I could tell you to just go to events and you can probably meet people there. But there's easier ways that are more direct to network, specifically to get on trips like this, that are a better use of your time. So, in particular, I really like calling the tourism board. Okay? That is really underrated. I mean, I think in general, phone calls are really underrated, but they. People who work in tourism boards or PR companies are used to being on the phone. They're phone people. And so they're really happy for you to call them and say, "Hey, I'm thinking about a trip to blah, blah, blah. What would you recommend?" And I've actually had people who I emailed to set up a trip be like, "Oh, I'm going to call you." And I was like, "Oh, actually, I'm in Turkey or something." But they really rely on the phone. And so if you are trying to get in touch with the tourism board and either you're having trouble or you feel like you don't have enough of an in, instead of sending them a sort of cold email where that's all they have to go on, bring your personality into it, show them that you're legitimate and they can trust you by calling them and building a connection that way. You don't have to meet the PR people at an event to do that. You can do it through just picking up the phone and building these one-on-one connections. Now, the other thing is that a good way, besides going to generic networking events, to build those connections is to go to these lunches. So some of you might have gone to these before, and I probably get more invites than most because I'm in New York, but I also get invited to these things in San Francisco and Dallas and other places. So if you live in a city, the PR firms in your city are regularly bringing in people from tourism boards that they represent to have meetings with people in the city. And so if you just write to the PR firm and say, "Hey, I cover travel, I'm interested in blah, 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 blah. Can you let me know when you have related events going on?" They will put you on these lists and you will start getting invited to these lunches. And this, like the interview trick that I mentioned before, is a really good way for people to just casually be like, "Oh yeah, we'd love to have you come check it out." And boom, there you go. That's your opportunity to set up an individually sponsored trip to that destination. Now, you can do the same thing that these tourism boards, whoops, are doing by stopping in to say hi yourself. So you can do this either with PR firms or with tourism boards, but if it's a place that's far away, obviously that's difficult. But you can go to the PR companies in your city and write somebody and say, "Hey, can I come in and chat with you about what I cover and see what clients you have that might be a fit?" And this can also be a really great way to just start getting those invitations for individual things coming to you without it having to be based solely on your publication track record or people finding you online. So we talked about interviewing for a roundup to get the invite for the next trip and how hotels are the real money. And so we're getting a little low on time. Oh, in fact, it's 4:30 already. So if any of you have to go, I'm so sorry we started late, and I really appreciate you sticking around with us already a little longer. And I'm going to start going through planning a specific trip now, and I'm going to try to wrap it up in the next 10 or 15 minutes. So if you can stay, I'm going to go through these next couple slides a little quickly, and if not, you can catch the remainder of the call on the replay, which will go out after the call today. So this trip over here is something that I set up like I said, 2 or 3 years back, and it was a very complicated itinerary. So this was a case where I had somebody traveling with me also who was a travel writer, or travel writer photographer, more photographers as well. And so she had her own outlets. So between the two of us, we split up, because it was such a hefty trip, who was contacting who about what. So in some destinations, like Asheville, I got us a stay at the Biltmore, which is the estate of the Vanderbilts, which now has a bunch of different hotels on it, and it costs like, it's like Disneyland. It costs like $60 just to get in. So if you don't get that sponsored, you're probably not going to go as a travel writer. And she was working on some other things because she wrote hotel reviews for some luxury travel sites. So in this case, like I said, this is a really large itinerary, so we're not going to go through exactly every single piece of it, but I'm going to go through the attack order. So in terms of when to go, you might notice the timing here is horrible. This is Labor Day weekend, actually, right here in the middle. But this was one of those things that it was the only time we could go. There was nothing we could do. And so we planned quite far in advance in terms of getting in touch with people. And I also was very careful that these days, whoops, that were the actual Labor Day weekend, we were doing things as much as possible that were either going to be completely on our own, self-guided, or that they were going to be in places where it would be easier for us to get stays. So going through these cities, you know, to start with, Charlottesville and Asheville are relatively big cities, but they're not on the level of a Nashville, okay? So for Nashville, I have worked with the tourism board there before, and they're not necessarily like intransigent, but they can be hard if you don't have a big story. But they have attractions there, like the Country Music Hall of Fame, some really great historic houses and things like that, that are really lovely to work with, and a lot of new hotel chains and new restaurant groups opening up. So in this case, when we were trying to go to Nashville, this was a case where I essentially bypassed the CVB for the purpose of this trip in order to more efficiently and effectively get things set up. However, in the case of the previous two Vills, so to say, Charlottesville and Asheville, I was able to go to the CVB, let them know I was coming, as well as going to some attractions directly that I wanted to go to. For instance, in Charlottesville, or outside of Charlottesville, actually is Monticello, which is Thomas Jefferson's former home. And as I mentioned, in Asheville, there's the Biltmore. So in those cases, you know, I could go to the CVB, and I have actually since gone to the CVB in Asheville and said, hey, I'm coming, figure, like, make up some stuff for me. And they did all the stays. But because it was a busy time, I don't know why I keep doing that, I'm so sorry. Because it was a busy time, I did my own legwork about where I wanted to go, and I'm going to show you some more about that on the next slide. And then I reached out to those places individually. And I did that both in terms of the attractions that we wanted to go to, as well as the places to sleep, as well as the restaurants. And so in Asheville, for instance, which is a really big foodie town, there's a guy who has gotten national coverage, and I've written about him several times, but I haven't gone on his tour, who does a foraging tour in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And so this was a case where it was really easy for us to just write them and say, hey, we're coming, like, when do you have a tour that we can join? And they said, great. They actually moved a tour to a different part of the day for us to go on to make sure that it would fit into our schedule. So like I said, the tour operators, even, you know, a guy who is a pretty big tour operator in a very foodie city, they're always very happy to accommodate you, because especially if it's not just a single person tour company, they can always bring in another guide. But again, I mentioned this in the last call, and I don't have a slide specifically on it this call, but remember the ethics of free travel. If you are going on a trip, it's not free, someone else is paying for it. And if it's a small company like a tour company, that owner is either giving you the tour himself so that he doesn't have to pay a guide, or he's paying a guide out of his pocket so that you can go on the tour for free. So especially with tours, always make sure that if the tourism board hasn't covered it for you, that you're tipping your tour guides, okay? So the next thing we did on here, and now we're starting to get into the holiday weekend, is I went to this place called Eureka Springs, which I had researched a couple times for some stories, and it's just this really weird, wacky place in Arkansas, and I'd never even been to Arkansas before, and this trip completely changed my conception of Arkansas, to be honest, in terms of a tourism destination. And so what I did here was that coming from Nashville to Eureka Springs, there were quite a few other stops of interest in Arkansas, actually, and so I reached out to the CVBs, and because they're not even second or maybe even third tier cities, they're really excited to help you and get out and roll out the red carpet for you. So I had meals set up for me. I had people give me, because we were doing a driving tour and we were short on time, I had somebody from the CVB hop in the car with me or drive me around and give me a little tour of their city. And so if you're looking to do the kind of thing where you have really, really one-on-one attention, especially if you're new, and this was why I mentioned starting with day trips, going to smaller destinations and going to the CVB directly can be a really great way to have somebody set up a whole itinerary for you that's going to give you a lot of trip story idea options that you wouldn't, because you're newer, have known to find on your own. So in the case of these two places, or this leg here, I really didn't know about a lot of these cities, and I had gotten in touch more generally with the tourism board of the state and was referred to some of these destinations, and then had a really, really great experience that taught me a lot of things that I was able to use in some other stories. So then in here, now we're on like the Friday of Labor Day weekend, and it's Atlanta, and there's a big football game. And we wanted to go to the new College Football Hall of Fame, which was doing some really innovative things in terms of the museum design. But there was a football game and there was nowhere to park. And so the person at the museum, though, knew all these things. So if we had just gone on our own to check out this museum during a football game on the holiday weekend, we physically never would have gotten there. There would not have been anywhere to put our car. And so this is one of the reasons that I really like to start, like I said, with the tourism board, because they know the whole schedule of their destination and they know all the tricks. So because we did that, you know, we were set up with a parking pass that somebody gave us as we drove by the museum, and then we put our car away and we were able to go, even though it was a very, very busy time. Now, the other thing, especially if you're on a road trip and you go to the state level tourism board first. So I mentioned up in Arkansas that they're able to connect you with some different cities to stop in. And in the case of Georgia, that was definitely apparent. So I had written some stories previously in a roundup format about Athens, which is really big for its music history. And there are several other small cities that have antebellum heritage between Athens and the coast, or between Atlanta and the coast. And so they're the type of things that are right on the way and very easy to stop in. But if we had been driving ourselves, we wouldn't necessarily have known how to make the best itinerary in terms of what exactly is going to be open when, where you have to stop for lunch versus where is good to stop for breakfast, and all those things. So by reaching out, they were able to help me schedule the best use of my time. And I have another side that I don't think we're going to get to, but the thing about time is that, like I mentioned with the hotels, people always want you to stay longer. They want you to stay for a lot of time, unless it's a big city and very expensive hotels. But most small tourism boards, most boutique hotels, they just want you to stay like forever. They always think, you know, that you'll get more by being there 5 days, 3 days, however many days, than one day or a half day. And so the thing is, if you have that time, that's really great. But I've also found that if you don't have a lot of time, going to the CVB can really be the best way to make sure you maximize it. So last week I shared an itinerary for an individual fam that I had taken that was actually to Macon, Georgia. And she put in not even a whole day, between maybe 8:30 or 8 and 3 p.m., like 10 different things, and like masterfully. And that's one of the really best reasons, if you are traveling on your own, even if you're not looking to get things paid for, to reach out to the CVB, because they will not only set those things up for you, but they will make the call so that the owner of the restaurant knows that you're coming and maybe even has the meal ready for you when you get there and is ready to answer some questions for you and things like that. So some of the other things on here to take note of. So the Georgia Islands, this is one of these things where, again, because it's a holiday weekend and we're looking at the islands, things get really, really hairy. But what I found was that on the coast of Georgia, so that includes Savannah and also Charleston, sorry, there's a typo there, as long as you are reaching out to these CVBs far enough in advance and you are very, very clear about what you need, they will set you up with the right things. So in Charleston, I arrived at my hotel and I had a lovely welcome bag that was from the CVB person, and I had all of my passes for all of my attractions there. So even though it was a holiday weekend and she wasn't around and she wasn't going to be guiding me, she was able to set those visits up. I had some theater tickets. I had some historic home tours that we were going to be doing. She was able to set all of those things up in a nice schedule for me in advance. Now, the next thing that I did was a little crazy, but I basically drove from the entire Outer Banks, which is probably like an 8 or 9 hour drive, by myself after the other folks with me had left. And I did that in part because I needed to get back for something, but also because it was going to be, you know, just a really great day because all the tourists had just left at the end of the weekend, and I really wanted to be able to get photographs in that environment. But what happened was that I had this really long drive, and then there was this tiny little town in Virginia, on the coast of Virginia, that's the peninsula side, so not the main Virginia coast. And it was this B&B, and I had been really interested in this town, and I reached out to this person, and we had everything set up, but I knew I was going to get there really late. And so I felt really bad, because here I am doing this free stay, and I want to chat with her and everything, and I know I'm going to get there really late. But what ended up happening was that not only, similarly to what I said about Charleston, was she super, super gracious about it and took care of it, but she also, you know, had given me suggestions of things to do along the way before I got there, knowing that it was going to be late. So, you know, she told me, don't forget to stop at blah, 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 because it's the last place that you'll be able to get food or gas before you get to us in the evening. You know, if you get to us and you're having trouble finding a parking spot, do this, this, and that. And so, obviously, if I had been just a revenue guest, just a paid guest at the hotel or at the Airbnb, at the B&B, she still would have been very gracious. But the fact that she knew I was coming, I was a journalist, and she wanted to make me have the best experience possible, really made what was a very long day in that trip so much better, because I had this very, very warm person. You know, I had her cell phone number if I had any problems to help me, even with things that weren't related just to the stay. And so that goes back to what I was saying, that often the people who are going to take not the best care of you, because I have great relationships with tourism boards, but the people who are going to, you know, be thinking really about your user experience are the people who come from a hotel background, because that's what they do with all of their guests. And then another thing here that's in terms of doing a day trip. So Alexandria is a place that I write about relatively regularly, and I usually go to in a non-work-oriented capacity because I have friends there. And so this was the kind of thing where I knew I was going to be there for a little bit in the afternoon, and I reached out to the CVB, and we just had a lunch. So basically, they said, okay, you're going to be here for lunch? Great. So they set up a reservation for us. They had a place for me to put my car. They brought a bunch of stuff that they wanted to talk to me about. They asked me what stories I have coming up. And we essentially had like a private version of these PR lunches that I was saying that you can set up, but just because I was in town. So this is the kind of thing where even if you're on a road trip and you're just passing through somewhere, just stopping off in that town and building that relationship can then open the door for future stories. So something that I had mentioned was that because we wanted to make sure that we weren't putting too much onus on the tourism boards because of the timing of our trip and everything, we made a really comprehensive list of restaurants, small businesses we'd be interested in profiling, attractions that we wanted to set out. And so every time I reached out to a CVB, I was already armed with these lists of different things that I knew that we were interested in. So I wasn't just going to them and saying, hey, I write about food and wine. Like, what would you recommend I do? I say, here are some things that we looked at, and then they can come back to you and volley and say, well, you know, that's great, but it's going to be really busy then, or the leaves will have already fallen, so you can't get great pictures, but maybe you want to try something else. So I already mentioned that once you're in, folks always have more things that they want to show you. And this can be a really great thing when you go on an individual trip, is that then you're going to be on the list for all of their future group trips, or that, you know, as long as you do the coverage that you talked about, they're going to want to have you back. So I have a lot of places that I go to, maybe not every year, but every year and a half or every 2 years or something, to update my research. And so the thing about these individual trips is that because you're having those meals, because you're having those one-on-ones with people, those tours, you're going to become somebody that they really know as a person and they think about when they're putting things together. Now, something that came up last week that I just wanted to make sure that we touched on is the chicken and egg problem of the assignment letters. And let's hope this is our next slide. I'm just going to go forward. What I really recommend about this, and I'm going to do a whole slide on this soon, is what I call the pitch portfolio. So what this is that you're not promising any specific stories, but you're saying, hey, I'm starting to set up my trip, and these are the places that I'm looking at pitching. These are all the stories I think I might do. Let's talk about what's going on in your destination. And so this is a way where you're showing them the potential coverage that they could get by working with you, but without making any specific promises. And so this is really important because I have a little list here that I'm just going to go through super quickly of the things to not do when you are writing people to set up individual trips. So one of them is, do not sound like you're writing from the 1800s. Do not sound so formal that you sound like an alien who has just learned English. And I'm not saying like if your English is a second language or anything like that, but I have seen these form letters that get passed around between people that they used to set up sponsored trips, and they are just really weird. And then I see some of the responses that people get, and they're like, oh, I don't know if this person is interested in sponsoring me. And I look at their letter, and I'm like, why did you say this? So these are people. Talk to them like people. Don't use lowercase hi to start your email, but build a relationship just like you're chatting with the barista at your coffee house, okay? Also, don't superlative drop unless it's true. Don't say you are the most influential, the most loved by CVBs, the most prolific, and I actually saw some letters that said this the other day, so I'm not making this up, unless you really are, because they can check. Also, don't promise publication. Unless you edit a website, unless it's your blog that you have control over or another website that you write for, never make a promise about publication, because as a freelancer, you just never know what's going to happen. And relatedly, be very careful not to say that you are asking for a hotel night in exchange for coverage, because even if you're not presently in one of these associations that we talked about that explicitly forbids these things, you might be in the future, and this is a big ethics faux pas. So don't say anything that implies a quid pro quo relationship between you getting something sponsored, whether it's a meal or a tour, and the outcome, the story that you'll publish, because that can often be an issue with your editors as well. On the topic of editors, don't say that you write for a publication that you have not written for in the past, or that you have a relationship with an editor and can publish a story in that place if you actually do not. I say this again out of actual experience. I've seen people say because they're friends with the editor from BBC Travel that they're going to publish a piece there or something like that. So when you use the pitch portfolio, you're being very honest that this is what you're thinking about pitching. This is your plan. But you're not saying in any way, shape, or form that you write for these places, that you will definitely write all of these articles. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great night.